the core of the business has to be solid before you can really expand into other areas.
Do me a solid. Consider yourself welcomed back to Wild Business Growth. This is your place to hear from a new entrepreneur every single Wednesday morning, turning wild ideas into wild growth. I'm your host, Max Brandstetter, founder and podcast producer at Max Podcasting. Yet again, I run out of breath while reciting this. This is episode 333, and today's guest is Eric Johnson, CEO of SurveyMonkey, the world's most popular platform for surveys and forms. In this episode, we talk all the touch points of the SurveyMonkey journey, what Eric is focused on, and a day in the life, so to speak, as CEO of a company that has over 1,000 employees, and the Beastie Boys. It is Mr. Johnson. Enjoy the show. Alrighty, we are here with Eric Johnson, CEO of SurveyMonkey, and apologize for how much we're going to monkey around. I've been planning that one for weeks. Thanks. But no, really, really cool, iconic company and an amazing leader. Eric, thank you so much for making time today. Thanks for joining. How are you doing today?
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you. I'm doing great. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, of course. And totally fair if you're going to jump off right after that opening line. So I appreciate you hanging in longer. But
the name lends itself to jokes. So I appreciate that. It's a very serious business and a friendly name.
So we're going to talk all things serious and friendly. So before we talk SurveyMonkey, I did some serious friendly stalking, as I call it, as research for this interview. And there's many interesting points in your background that we can talk to today. But one that jumped out at me is a little bit unique was, I believe it was called Wolfgang's Vault, but also now seems it's known as Wolfgang's. But that is in the music and music publishing space or music catalog space. What's your tie or affinity to working in the music space professionally?
I was a banker out of college. So I worked in investment banking for about 11 years and I left in 2005 and decided I wanted to do something on the operating side. And my focus was really finding something that was small enough that they would let me have a important role and make some decisions. And I wanted something that was consumer centric. And I met a guy named Bill Sagan, who had bought the Bill Graham archives out of Clear Channel when they were spinning out Live Nation. And it was this extraordinary collection of live concert recordings and concert memorabilia and the intellectual property attached to all of this. And Bill had spent time with a team digitizing all these assets and building this e-commerce business. And I came in, I think, about a year and a half after they put the business together. And we built out what was this pretty extraordinary collection of other archives. We acquired a couple of studios and recorded new bands. And we had this amazing e-commerce business. It was niche, but it was wild how the recordings that we had, audio and video, and had this great chance to work in music for about 5 years. It was fun, and it was my first real exposure to what it meant to work in a business and not just on the advisory side.
In a business is one thing, but in a business in the music space, like I feel like the music space, especially for the past couple of decades, has changed more than potentially any industry out there. What kind of shocked you or slapped you upside the face about the music industry based on that first experience?
There were probably two sides to it. One was just operating a business. And back then, when we were building an e-commerce business, you didn't have Stripe. You didn't have these tools that you could use as elements of your platform. We had to build most of the stuff ourselves. We built a music streaming service that we had on Apple in particular, and then worked with Sonos and had an app on Sonos, and we were Mac's app of the year that in 2008, I think. On Time, when they had their 50 coolest websites, we were there. And so that running a business, the exposure, the day-to-day. And the fun thing of that was I was literally dealing with music labels and looking for acquisitions and folding t-shirts and dealing with customer service calls and building a team that was before we had product managers, building product and designing websites and thinking about what the service overall should look like. And so you had this really cool exposure to running a business and everything soup to nuts. And you had the music business, which is a fascinating mix, I'll say, of copyrights and intellectual property and good conversations and you know, work to get the stuff out there. And yeah, the music business has changed massively. And we were kind of in the middle of that transition where people were starting to launch streaming services. And it's now become the default. But we were early, and we were also this interesting live, recorded live music version of which there's some others out there as well. But it was a really fun one, fascinating one to work on and kind of get my feet wet in the operating side.
And I'll credit you with a very well thought out pun there with mix in the music industry, a mix, a playlist. So, you know, well done there. And actually music and ticketing in-person events actually ties exactly to what you were doing right before or right at the start of 2020 and eventually before you got to SurveyMonkey. Can you just give us a little snapshot of why COVID, which has, you know, been really good and really bad for some businesses that locked down in 2020, including many guests we've had on the show. Can you share why it wasn't the best thing for that startup you had?
We had this really interesting business that was a joint venture between Live Nation and a group called the Azoff Company. And Irving Azoff and now the team there have built one of the biggest music management businesses in the world. Irving's a legend in the industry. And what we built was a digital service to power live events and focusing on the high end of the music market to begin with. And I had gotten some pieces wrong in the business model early. We kind of corrected those through 2018, and the business was working really well. We worked with some massive artists like the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac and Harry Styles and Travis Scott and this crazy list of A-list artists, and it was working. It was a place where Lane One was the company and people knew the name. They were using it in the, I'm going to buy a Lane One, the where you want to be as a brand, like I'm going to launch a SurveyMonkey kind of thing. And 2020 started off just absolutely on fire. We had some huge shows. We had travel working on. We had a B2B model that we were building out. And we're working closely with Amex and Live Nation on some of these elements. And then March of 2020 hit and just shut the door. And you know, I think collectively managed the transition well, but there was just nothing. It was all based on live events, and the Ticketmaster and Live Nation, who owned half the business, were in the place where they were preserving cash everywhere to be in the position they're in now or the last couple of years, which was coming out of COVID. If you could survive that winter, it's been extraordinary, and they've done an amazing job of that, but our business just didn't have the staying power at that point to make it through, which was frustrating because we had done a lot of things right as a investor group, as a board, as a team, and we had this cool small team in San Francisco and Nashville that had built something pretty special.
Well, speaking of SurveyMonkey, which you alluded to, let's get to a really special and unique company that personally, like, you know, I've been a fan of SurveyMonkey and used you guys ever since going back. I think I was in like high school first time I heard about you guys, and now I'm still in high school. No, I'm just kidding. It's really cool to see how the company's grown and evolved over the years. And what was it that brought you back? You know, you've had a mix of entrepreneurial and also leading existing companies. What was it about SurveyMonkey in particular, besides just monkeys being super cool and fun and serious, as you said? What is it that brought you to SurveyMonkey?
It was a combination of things, one of which is the brand is iconic. It is 25-year-old business that is known worldwide. We've got customers in 173 countries. We have about 1,000 people spread around the globe on the team. And I loved the idea of working with that brand and thinking about what do those next 25 years look like? How does this business evolve? I really like the business model. We have this core product-led growth model that feeds a pretty big enterprise sales motion as well. And the balance is really interesting. The fact that the product is the best advertisement for the company, when you send a survey, you are sending our brand to dozens or hundreds or thousands of people. And that's kind of the genius of the way the model works. And it's PLG before PLG was a thing. When the Findlay brothers created this business 25 years ago, there didn't exist an online survey market. There was no one was thinking about this as an accessible tool. It was in the hands of high-end researchers, but to make this something that was practical and easy to use for, you know, then hundreds, now hundreds of thousands of paying customers, it's amazing. And it's endured because the basic principles have applied, which is it's this really powerful tool that's easy to use for a broad set of people that is from that startup all the way through massive corporations.
And real quick, PLG, I could guess, but what does it stand for?
Sorry, product-led growth. So the simple notion that using the product should drive awareness and should drive more usage. And you see that SurveyMonkey is a great example. You've got DocuSign, another great example of, you know, you sign something, you get pulled into the flow, and there's a whole bunch of others. You know, again, the beauty is that the product, when done well, does a whole lot of that work of acquiring new customers.
I was going to guess it was a professional lacrosse club in Paris. So thank you for explaining that one. But yeah, so clearly an iconic and fun brand, and the brand speaks for itself. And as you were saying, the product speaks for itself. In your experience, kind of leading the charge so far, what's been the biggest difference between like the main goals and priorities offerings of SurveyMonkey today versus kind of like the early days when it started as probably purely a survey company?
Yeah, it's a good question. There are maybe four or five different phases, if you can indulge me for a minute, in the history of SurveyMonkey, which is the initial founding, which was these two brothers who started it in the Midwest. And the story goes that they, one Friday night, unplugged the server, drove to Portland, plugged it back in Portland, and then really built the business out on the West Coast, and then built this really impressive self-funded business. I think they took some money on later, but really had built this things themselves, and it was profitable from the early days. And then the business was acquired by a private equity group called Spectrum with Dave Goldberg back in 2009, moved the headquarters to Palo Alto, and realized they had this gem that could use a push, and they invested in, sort of plowed all those earnings back into growth and drove a really impressive number of years of growth. Dave sadly passed away in 2015, and a guy called Xander Lurie took over as CEO. They added and pushed hard, moving on top of that product-led growth into the enterprise. So pushing for more enterprise features, adding elements that work well from security and sign-on and admin authorization, plus feature sets in the product, and took the company public in 2018 and was public company up until May of 2023 when it was taken private by a group called STG. And I joined right after the company was taken private. You know, the evolution of the business has been sort of just that, which is that core has remained, which is people seeking feedback, asking questions, using that to drive value for their business. And I think there's sort of the simplified version of we're going to survey our softball team to see what they want on our pizza. But The reality is that the usage is extraordinary. When you think about the employee feedback, the customer satisfaction feedback, marketing tests that are both existing customers or panel based, and the value that people drive to make decisions is what you see in the success of the business and then the success, frankly, of the industry. And so there's been competition that's obviously sprouted up over the years that are going after different segments of the market. We remain, I believe, the sweet spot of the market, which is, again, this balance of easy to use and a really powerful business tool. The business had gone through a shift when the market was, the stock market was putting a huge premium on enterprise sales growth. There was that window of time, end of 2019 up through early COVID and into 2021, when the multiples on these SaaS companies were crazy. And so there was a really hard push towards the enterprise. And in fact, the business was rebranded as Momentive, where SurveyMonkey was still a product brand within that, but there were a couple of other pieces alongside of that within the company. And after the deal was done and we went private, we went back to SurveyMonkey. It was kind of the first decision announcement that I got to make, which was well received in the company. And the brand move made a lot of sense back then. It really was that focus and that premium. So there was good logic to it. But the brand SurveyMonkey is such an interesting asset and so well known. And you were working hard anywhere to rise above the fray and get the name out there, that to not leverage that as a core asset just didn't make sense in this phase that we're in now.
It makes a lot of sense. And that's, you know, like an extreme example of that name change is what people are talking about now with HBO and HBO Max and then to Max and then back to HBO Max. And then ultimately a lot of people are like, you know, you have such great branding with HBO, why switch it? And I think the SurveyMonkey name speaks to itself and speaks for itself. It monkeys around itself. But in terms of, you know, leading a company that, you know, over the years is known for kind of top of mind doing one thing incredibly well, obviously the survey, it's in the name, surveys and forms and everything there. How do you kind of navigate that? Like, what's your strategy as CEO in terms of leading a company, like making sure you can be like the best of the best as far as offering those surveys and forms, but also like finding ways to continue to grow the company, you know, with some of the new things involved?
Yeah, it's a good question. I have a very firm belief that the core of the business has to be solid before you can really expand into other areas. Otherwise, you're trying to fill gaps that are being created on that core. And you have to earn the right to go into other categories. I had an old boss who always referred it to, you can't skip levels in a video game. You've got to beat the boss at the end of each set to then build yourself up for those next levels. And I think it applies, which is you need to go into categories that are either adjacent for your customers. So thinking about what can we offer for that existing buyer that works alongside of our platform or within the platform. So forms as a use case is a sweet spot of our platform. But we still aren't thought of as much for forms. If you read the online reviews in G2, we're always the number one online forms provider. But because our name is SurveyMonkey, people think about other forms products. When 20% of our use cases are forms, it's just not thought of. And there's opportunities there that's both positioning in the product, marketing, the website, the messaging. So to me, it's a combination of you have to understand the details of what are the levers that drive the business and make sure that there is a real strength in that core. And then find these areas that are adjacencies, find use cases that are complements to how people are using the product today, offer those up, make those easy to find, discover, buy, use. I think it's the same for most businesses. And some you can get to a certain size and say, all right, we're Amazon, we're going into self-driving cars. Fine, right? You know, you've earned that right at that scale. And again, I think for us, it's really about those adjacent categories that work for the core buyers of the platform, whether that's HR or CX or marketing, other use cases that we see, and finding ways to reach out to them, either with new products, features in the existing product or just ways to use the existing platform.
I think you stumbled onto your next huge product extension there is monkey driving cars.
There you
go. Like the Survey Monkey mobiles, I think, you know, who would say no? I'm always fascinated by the CEO role, especially in a huge company. And it's like the cliche, like you have to wear so many different hats. And so I'm always fascinated what your role kind of actually looks like. You have a really interesting background where like you have the finance side, you have the marketing side as well. Obviously there's music side that we spoke to. What do you think is like come in handy the most so far in as CEO of SurveyMonkey?
I think it's a combination of a lot of the background. The finance helps. The beauty of banking is you pick up some skills where you can look at an income statement, you can look at a balance sheet and understand pretty quickly what's going on. And importantly, use that to think about what you can do next and understand where there are issues and opportunities. The trick then is turning that into something you can operationalize. I'm not sure that's a word, but how can you translate that to a company? And what do these numbers mean? What's good in them? What's bad in them? What are the details that are important? And I am a little bit obsessive around details and always have been. I love data, talking about data and understanding the specifics of it and what are the drivers of that. And my background in digital entertainment, consumer-focused brands actually works really well for our business because the core front end of SurveyMonkey is getting people into the business and using the product at scale. And about two-thirds of our business is people buying the software online with a credit card, using it, engaging them, finding ways to design the product differently. And I am a massive believer in the value of design and product interaction. And I think we still have opportunities where we can keep evolving what we're doing. And so understanding how to build consumer products has been a real value for translating that to a really powerful survey platform, software product that has these use cases for, you know, again, a broad array. The common theme is the user and the evolution of software where it used to be these really bad UI that you had to deal with. And now we're all in a place where we're, you know, using stuff like Figma and SurveyMonkey and others that are great designed products that are fun and easy to use.
Yeah, I imagine it gets pretty trippy when you think about it of like, you know, so many companies out there need to do market research. And for you, it's like you already build the tools yourself. So you can just tap into that. You know the people, you can make a call. But if you were to look at like an area of the business or potential area of the business that is kind of picking up steam as like a big, big focus in the coming years, what would you say?
The obvious theme is AI.
What is that? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, I get it. Alan
Iverson. Yeah. You want to focus on practice.
Focus on the 76ers. The theme that I believe, or the trend that I believe, is that human feedback is going to be even more valuable over these coming years. That there's these ideas around synthetic feedback, which is interesting, which is building a market research product that uses AI to simulate what customers would say. To me, that highlights the exact challenges of every large language model, is that they're only up to date as much as they're up to date. And so the value of real human feedback is that you're getting real-time information from people and they are telling you what they believe, and it's based on changes that were made. It's based on new updates that they understand or the way they feel that week. And machines are not doing that well, and they cannot predict that yet. Maybe, I don't know, but I do believe that that core driver and the use of feedback in people's business has just grown massively. And the pace at which that's accelerating is exciting. And the speed at which you can collect and use that information is pretty cool. And it's one of the big pitches and push for us, which is that speed to insight And not just so you can show a PowerPoint presentation that shows pie charts and, you know, what people feel about things, but to really think about, okay, if it's employee feedback and it's your benefit survey, what are we doing with our providers as we go into that next year? How are we making decisions on the dollars that we're spending that make a difference to our employees? If it's customer satisfaction, where are those sticking points that they're hung up on that you aren't just seeing in the click data, but you're seeing in those responses that are the nuances in between? And AI is really helpful for aggregating some of those responses and offering up ideas to use and to focus on. But I think that the value of human feedback is only increasing, and it's one of these, you know, really cool assets we have because of our scale and the way the platform works for people.
You hit on a great point as far as speed goes, and thinking about SurveyMonkey, a couple of things as far as like sending out surveys and forums that comes to mind that you guys do so well is like the speed and then the ease of use and like simplicity of it. You don't need to reveal all your tricks, but internally, how do you kind of get those core principles across throughout such a giant organization?
It's tricky, right? Because you get into this focus on a set of features, and the teams are building at pace and building with the user in mind and customer requests and ideas around where to take the product. And as you roll out features, you're trying to find ways to integrate that into a core platform and make that obvious and usable for the customer, the user. And you need to have a holistic view of what does that experience and that flow look like. And so I think it is the challenge and the beauty of a design team and a product team working with their developers to deliver that balance. And there, I don't think there's a secret sauce. I think it really is about that tension. I think the thing that we've done well as an organization is building an experiment culture into everything we do. And sometimes you can go too far and you can do these micro experiments that are too detailed when you could just change the button or the color of something and move forward. But that mindset's really powerful and valuable. And that key is guiding people down paths to test things that are going to move the needle for the business, for the customer, in service of that goal, which is marrying easy to use with a powerful platform.
Yeah, that's like a really insightful but scary thing that you just shared, because a culture of experimentation is amazing. Like, I think that's what name any successful company in the past 2 or 3 decades, like that has been, it's like there's so many companies that incentivize employees to, well, putting it lightly, you know, play around a little bit as far as experimenting some new ideas that are kind of outside the box. And the scary part of that is like, if you're working at a company that specializes in surveys and forums and market research, theoretically you can test anything. So how do you keep that focus that you spoke of making sure that the testing is truly meaningful and that, you know, the team is being still efficient with everything?
It is exactly the right question. And it is both the benefit of this experimentation culture and a product that is built for feedback that is really important, and also having confidence in decisions and making decisions and not waiting for that 99th bit of feedback, but that first 98 are important and valuable. And there is some value in having people that understand what statistical significance looks like and a relevant sample size and moving forward based on a certain amount of data is powerful. And so, again, I think it really comes back to making sure the team understands what are the levers that move the business, what are the things that our customers value, what are the things that are challenges for our customers, and are we solving those with the work we're doing? And if not, and we're just tweaking a button, let's reprioritize and let's not experiment for the sake of experimenting, but keep that mindset and do it for that customer and make changes that will make a difference again for the customer and then for the business.
So let's tweak the interview a little bit. I'm going to hit a button here that's going to switch it up a little bit. I mean, I typically call this segment like inspiration and creativity. And I'm really curious, like, without a doubt, being a CEO at a well-known company is known as being a very stressful job. And so there's a lot you need to manage, you know, internally with yourself, in addition to not even mentioning the organization. So do you have any tips and tricks that you've learned over years and your time leading companies for like how to keep it as lower stress as possible for yourself in the day-to-day scenarios you're in?
I think it's different for everyone. I will say the absolute most important on the job stress management tip is make sure you have a fantastic team. And that number one job of any CEO is the hiring a team, and maybe complement to that is making sure there's space for that team to do their job well. I think that is the most important thing. And I've got this amazing combination of people that have been at SurveyMonkey for a long time and some very new people. And that balance works really well. And it's people in senior roles that have either been recruited into those roles or promoted up. That as a both balance that is giving you real feedback that is feels comfortable sharing the good and the bad. And then as a point of leverage for everyone in the organization, having a confident and smart and empathetic management team makes day-to-day life much better. I mean, I've gotten to the point where I'm old enough that I really care about working with people that I like, and it matters. And that is something that I've been, again, both really lucky in the people that were there, and I think lucky also in people we've hired that are genuinely good human beings and really good at their jobs. That at work, it sounds obvious, but I do think that is the great lever anybody has in any executive position, who you work with.
Yeah, and you take that back. You're not old, so I don't want to hear any of that flying around. But.
Well, you can look at my LinkedIn. People can do the math. Right? Subjective.
No calculators allowed. So that's kind of like in the business and the day-to-day from that standpoint. How about when you're like, are you able to find any sort of way to unplug or like have room for any hobbies in your life?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, family's first, and I'm super lucky. I've got a wife. We've been married for... I should know this. 22 years.
I was gonna just look at your LinkedIn.
Yeah, exactly. And two awesome kids who are 14 and 11, and a little dog. And it's great. We've got a pretty tight knit family. One of the great things coming out of COVID was, as bad as it was for my business, I had a lot of time on my hands, and we started doing family dinner every night. And we don't quite do every night now. My wife's busy. She's got a big job. But we make it a priority. That's the most important for me. The other thing I do just as a hobby is I like to run. I ran with a team for a little bit in my 30s and early 40s and have not kept it up at that level. But I try and run 5 days, 6 days a week. And it is my great stress reliever as a sort of daily. I feel better, and starting my day with that makes a big difference for me.
How early is your wake up typically?
5:40 is my typical.
All right, that's not bad. I don't know. You hear some stories about runners waking up at 3 or 4.
I know some of those people, and I am not running far enough these days to need to get up that early. So.
Yeah, they're inventing longer and longer marathons to run.
Exactly.
What is it about running, those morning runs, that helps you prepare yourself for the day, work day?
I have either my most productive or least productive 45 minutes of the day when I'm running, and both are super valuable. I either get an earworm song stuck in my head that loops for 40 minutes, or I start thinking about an issue at work, an idea that I want to talk about, a presentation I've got to give, and I can work through that on a run. And like I said, those days where it's next to nothing is amazingly valuable, because the physical side of it's great, and there's a little bit of a release in not thinking about things for a period of time. Again, it really is just a a hobby I love and keeps me in decent enough shape where it sort of helps day to day. And then there are some productive moments in there that are pretty useful.
I hate when productive moments are useful.
It's exactly.
Oh, man. What about on the, as far as like people you look up to, like, are there any other CEOs out there, past or current, that are kind of big inspirations or you try to model some of your game after?
I'll cite an old boss and a good friend of mine, a guy named Jim Lanzone, who is a CEO at Yahoo now. I think because he was a friend, we had a really good relationship as a boss. And the basic principle he had was, you know, you hire experts, they will hire experts, that you solve for that and you give people space to run their business, do their job. And he was a detail-oriented guy that, you know, I think really changed. He was running CBS Interactive when I was there running a group in his division, and then running Yahoo. They've done an amazing job of turning that business around. And I think that the balance of detail-oriented and providing that space for people to work and run is a really healthy lesson for anyone as you grow in manager ranks. It's hard to let go. And you have to realize that you have to. And I struggle with that some days where the details are important and you need to back off on some things, and finding that and treating that the right way is really important. So there's a number of others. I've got, you know, a good friend also who runs a business called Bellring Brands, which is a very different business, which is in the consumer products food business, Darcy Davenport. And she came up from the marketing side, and this business was spun out of Post and is just a monster on the market now. And I think the way she leads, the way she thinks about managing people, you know, as humans, is so powerful, and you can see the success that comes from that.
All right. Well, we're about to see you as a real human here, the most human you've ever been. We're wrapping up with rapid fire Q&A. You ready for it?
Let's do it.
All right. Let's get wild. As wild as monkeys of the survey variety. All right. I know you went to school at Princeton. We live in New Jersey. Shout out Jersey. You know, you're based in Bay Area now. I'm always interested, like, the love-hate about, some people love Eastern time, some people love Pacific time. What's your take on it? Like, the biggest, other than the 3-hour difference, what's the biggest difference about living and working in those worlds?
I lived in New York for about 5 years after college and loved it. I wouldn't trade living in New York for anything, and I'm glad I moved.
Yeah, that's what everybody says, yeah.
The West Coast, I feel like, has a little more balance to life. And there's certainly parts of the East Coast that have that good balance, and certainly parts of the Bay Area and other places that don't have the balance. But I do feel like the lifestyle on the West Coast, it's better suited for me. There's winters aren't really winters, and you can be outdoors as much as you want. From a time zone standpoint, it's interesting. I mean, if you just go time zone, East Coast is better from a time zone standpoint. You can work with more of the world. You've got, there is the center of the world in New York, and that's real. But I grew up on the West Coast, and I'm kind of partial. So there's that.
So my brother-in-law, shout out Adam, lives in Orange County, and we went out to visit him a few years ago, right before you started serving. No, but, you know, it was like my first time in California in a long, long time, and lived on Eastern time my entire life, except for one summer in Texas. And when you're so used to Eastern time and then you go out there, I had the sensation of like always feeling behind unless you wake up super early out there. Was that an adjustment for you at all?
It was. And in, you know, I was in banking at the time. And so you sort of work a little bit of market hours. I wasn't trading, so I didn't have to be on right away. But day is starting at 9 East Coast.
Whether so, you're up or not. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's important that you are up early and you adjust your schedule accordingly. I had a good friend who was from Jersey, lived in New York, and would make fun of the West Coast because of the football times. He's like, it's not a real place if you're starting an NFL game at 10 a.m. he now lives out here and realizes how great it is that you're starting those games at 10 a.m. And importantly, the last game ends before midnight. So, you know, there's some benefits for sure.
Yeah, Adam always talks about like NFL Sunday brunch. It's the best thing. But exactly. Yeah, that would be the biggest adjustment for me is like, what, you know, if there's like a playoff game and it starts at like 4 p.m. or something, I'm like, oh, wow, that's a lot different. So, all right, enough about time zones. Credit Standard Time for sponsoring this episode. No, I'm just kidding. What is an earworm that's been stuck in your head on one of your runs recently?
That's a great question. I have a pretty broad array of music interests. Well, the one that always gets stuck in my head is a Beastie Boys song, Paul Revere, which came out when I was in sixth grade. And I can still sing every lyric of that song. If I have a go-to karaoke song, it is that.
You're welcome to if you want.
We'll do that when the video's up.
Yeah, exactly. All right. No Sleep Till Brooklyn. What was like the biggest thing that surprised you about moving from the finance world to like a more marketing company?
The challenges that come with managing and managing people well was interesting. I worked with a lot of people, obviously, in banking and managed teams of people, but it's different. It was deal related and it was specific to a project versus the day to day that sometimes can be a grind because sometimes you're working on something for 8 months, a year, the core of what you're doing, and keeping people motivated and keeping people focused on what makes a difference was a really interesting learning to me. I thought I knew what that looked like and I learned a lot actually being in there and making mistakes and getting some stuff right and realizing what your own management style looks like and not needing to define that, but you sort of get a sense of what works and doesn't for you.
All right. And then last one, clearly the most important. If you were reincarnated as an actual monkey, what monkey would you like to be?
I do not know enough about the primate family to give you a good. So I'm going to say a howler monkey.
I'm howling along for that one. Howling for You, another song, Black Keys, that gets stuck in your head. So Eric, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate you sharing your time and insights and wisdom and Beastie Boys love. Just a big fan of what you're doing and SurveyMonkey. And I know if anybody wants to learn more or do some SurveyMonkeys themselves, they can do so at surveymonkey.com. Eric, if somebody wants to connect with you online, where's the best place for that?
Yeah, on LinkedIn is the best place to reach out. And surveymonkey.com, as you said, is the best place to find more about what we're doing.
Perfect. Awesome. And then what's your second favorite type of monkey? No, I'm just kidding. Last thing, final thoughts. It could be a quote, just kind of a mantra, words to live by, whatever you want. Send us home here.
The mantra that I live by for work is better is better. Find ways to make a difference that are small, that build over time. And it's a core principle that we operate by at SurveyMonkey and one that I try and live by.
True words to live by. Thank you so much, Eric, for coming on Wild Business Growth, sharing the SurveyMonkey story and your story. And thank you, Wild listeners, for tuning in to another episode. If you want to hear more wild stories like this one, make sure to follow Wild Business Growth on your favorite podcast platform and hit subscribe on YouTube for the video versions. YouTube is at Max Brandstetter. You can also learn all things podcast production and sign up for the Podcasting to the Max newsletter and learn more about the podcast at maxpodcasting.com. Until next time, let your business run wild.
Bring on the bongos!